start that. I didn't need correcting.
Shut up! Order!
Order! Let's start off as we need to go on.
We can see a better future.
So it's not a competition who can shout the loudest.
Hello, I'm Ashan, and you're listening to the Left Wingers podcast. We are an unashamedly left-wing political podcast made by activists for activists. All right, so today we're joined by Professor John Denham, who is current director of the English Labour Network, as well as an academic at the University of Southampton, former cabinet minister holding various different roles under the last Labour government. And today we'll be talking a lot more about his work with Englishness and Labour and the sort of combination between our progressive patriotism and what we can do into the future. So, John, for anyone who doesn't know who you are or what you do, could you give a brief explanation about your sort of background and what you're currently up to now?
Okay, so I, as you said, I was an MP. I was a minister in the Labour government for 10 years. I did leave the government for a time over the Iraq war when I chaired the Home Affairs Select Committee. I became interested in the question of national identity and politics, largely initially in being put in charge of the response to the Northern riots that took place in 2001, which showed huge community divisions and very separated communities. And since then, I've more closely looked at England in particular and at English identity. And that's my the particular focus of my work. It's about the politics of England, the way that England is governed, the challenge of creating a sort of unified sense of English identity or an English story that can tackle the very real problems that face England.
Yeah, so from sort of your background in government, was increasingly within the party, I know in last year particularly when the England World Cup squad were doing so well, there's a big conversation about how England are doing and how Labour and England can mesh together. Back in 2001 when you first, or back in the 2000 when you first became active in the Labour government, was that an issue then as it is now? And what were sort of they doing?
The really interesting thing is that in 1996, there was the European Football Championships were in London, and a very similar thing happened. And there was a very organized attempt by progressive activists to actually promote a sense of inclusive Englishness during that tournament. And it was a time, probably the first time, when people got a sense that the St. George's flag belonged to everybody and not to in some backwater of the far right, which was what it was always labeled as being. The sad thing, I think, is that that momentum was never maintained. And Labour has to take some of the responsibility for that, because the early thing we did was we devolved power to Wales, we devolved power to Scotland, we devolved power to Northern Ireland, but we left the government of England entirely unchanged under the Union government as it sits at the moment. The Labour Party doesn't talk about England. If you look back at the 2019 election, we promised to rebuild Wales, we promised to rebuild Scotland, and in England, and only in England, we promised to rebuild Britain. And I'm afraid most Labour Party front bench spokespeople today, if they're talking about English schools, will talk about British schools, even though Britain is England, Wales and Scotland. They'll talk about the British Health Service rather than the health service in England. That's a real problem for two reasons. One is, as a result of devolution, for 20 years, English health policy, schools policy, university policy, transport policy has been separate. But England has no sense of being a political nation or a political government. The second problem is that the state has centralized England, so it's the most centralized nation in Europe. And if you look at why is England so unequal? Why is it so divided by race, by geography, by income, by age, by education? A lot of that has got to do with the failure of a centralized government in Westminster and Whitehall to deal with it. So we really should be talking about England, not just about English identity, but England as a whole and how it's governed and how we get more of a shared sense of purpose.
So are you pro or anti devolution?
I'm pro devolution. I think that I want to see the United Kingdom. What the United Kingdom at the moment is, it's the remnants of a unified British state, you know, which before the Second World War was at the centre of an empire. After the Second World War, with the Attlee government, it was part of building a unified British national economy. what we've now got is devolution to Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, but England is governed by the rump of that British state. Now, what we should be doing is thinking much more of the United Kingdom as a union of nations in which there are shared interest in things that need to be shared, like macroeconomic policy, like trade policy, like defence policy, which all the nations should have a role in shaping. But at national level, then what I want to see is both England-wide policy and dramatic devolution within England to England's localities. So we've got to get ourselves out of the mindset of thinking that really we're trying to run the what's left of the United Kingdom from Whitehall and think more about a union of nations. And in my view, that's not only the best way to get a good government for England, it's the best way, probably the only way of keeping the union together in the 21st century.
And do you think Labour are doing enough now to talk about that? Or is that problem still persist that they can't separate the sort of far right aspect of Englishness with the sort of political ideas that you spoke?
I don't think the Labour Party is addressing either Englishness as an inclusive national identity or the government of England. And I'm sorry to say that. We're waiting, of course, for Gordon Brown's report, the Commission on the Future of the UK. But the language that he's been using, a union of nations and regions, suggests that he's still where the Labour Party was 20 years ago, that Scotland can be a nation, Wales can be a nation, but England's just got to be carved up into regions. It's hugely unpopular with the voting public. And it'll be a disaster if we do that. And I hope we don't. And secondly, we haven't begun to think about a key thing. How do we separate out the government of England from that of the United Kingdom? Now, you think about a nation, you think about effective policy in any local area, the ones that you live in. You want your health policy and your education policy and your care policy and your crime policy to work well together to tackle disadvantage, to deal with social problems. Everybody will tell you in English local government that central government's not joined up, that its education policies don't fit with its health policies and so on. Why is it not joined up? Because it's not joined up at national level. Instead of having a coherent machinery of government of England, we've got some departments that are dealing with the whole of the union, some that are only England, some that are England and Wales. There's not even a committee in Whitehall that coordinates the delivery of national policy across England. It's extraordinary, and it's why things are so dysfunctional at that sort of level. Now, I'd love to say that I thought the Labour Party was getting to grips with those issues. I don't think it's even begun to think about them. I think there are too many people thinking we will come into Whitehall, we'll come into Westminster, we'll win an election, and then we'll sit in Whitehall pulling levers. Well, I did that as a minister, sat in offices, pulling a lever, trying to change everything from Cornwall to Cumbria. It didn't work. The levers weren't attached to anything. The power needs to be out of Whitehall into England's localities, into its communities, its counties or its cities or whatever. Labour needs to be thinking about government in those terms.
On the delivery of it, you've mentioned in your writings, as well as if anyone's got a chance on the English Labour Network website as well, there's a lot of sort of discussion on an English parliament. How would you, if you were to deliver an English parliament as a minister or as a party, how would you go about doing it?
Right. I think what we have to do is have a series of what I call strategic but incremental reforms. So individual changes you can bring in over the period of perhaps two parliaments to move us from where we are at the moment to something more like a union of nations. And I've just set this out recently in a new paper for Compass and Unlock Democracy. So if I can take the parts of it, firstly, in Whitehall, you need to separate out things that are union-wide from the government of England and set up a clear machinery of government for England. Secondly, you need to put the relationships with the devolved nations on a statutory basis. The Johnson government has been reasserting central control over things we all thought had been devolved to Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. They need to be given their clear rights within the union. And then as you go forward, you need to bring in electoral reform. One of the problems we've got at the moment is that a minority of English voters have imposed a conservative British nationalist government on the whole of the United Kingdom, right? It's tearing the union apart. So you need to have an electoral reform which brings in a fairer electoral system. And when you do that, you can do what the majority of voters in England have wanted for 20 years, which is genuinely let English MPs in Westminster make English laws and hold ministers accountable for the delivery of English policy. So I wouldn't move, if I'm honest, to a freestanding English parliament as an immediate objective. I'd love to wake up tomorrow and there'd be one. But if you go through the process of how would you get there, you'd have to bring everybody together to rewrite the entire constitution, financial arrangements, laws, all the rest of it, of the entire United Kingdom in one go. There's not a cat in hell's chance of doing that. So we've got to think much more cleverly and move much more incrementally. And so that as England takes on its own identity, the rest of the union becomes free from the idea that they're always going to be pushed around by an English government. And of course, one of the things about electoral reform is that it would quieten any Labour fears that somehow if you had English votes for English laws, the Tories would always run England. They wouldn't. The Tories only run England because we have an unfair electoral system that distorts their level of support.
So one of the things I thought was really interesting there was your concept is to actually just rejig the PLP to be the UK PLP or the British PLP, but then also the English PLP, the Welsh PLP and the Scottish PLP. So the Parliamentary Labour Party, just to clarify for our listeners. But then Keir Starmer does all these speeches. We've seen it in flag wars recently. Who's got the bigger flag, Boris or Keir? How many flags have you got behind you when you're speaking to prove how patriotic you are or to prove how much you value being British? Would you tell him, stop the British flags and just part English flags because you're an English leader and you're an English MP?
What I would say to him is two things. One is over the last 20 years, Labour has lost every battle about national identity. We've lost the battle about what it is to be Scottish. We've lost the battle about what it is to be English. We've lost the battle to be about what it is to be British. The only place we've done it well is in Wales. And what happens in Wales, we completely ignore them because it's Wales. But they're the place that has actually managed to combine genuinely radical progressive politics with a deep sense of national identity. And they've done that without turning against the union or becoming anti-British or anti-English, but drawing on that identity. So I would say to Keir, the flag, the union flag is fine. If you're talking about the United Kingdom, that's the flag of the United Kingdom. But there are times when you're talking about England, and therefore you need to, I don't care what flag you've got, by the way, but name England. You talk about England all the time. Don't just do a video on St. George's Day, which is really a nice video he did on St. George's. You can't just do it on St. George's Day. When we're talking about England, name England. If we're talking about the United Kingdom, name the United Kingdom. The second thing I can, if I'm not going on too long on this one, is to say, patriotism of flags is probably the minimum necessary to get elected because the voters won't vote for somebody who's unpatriotic. But there are not many votes in patriotism per se. What Labour's got to do is to express our radical politics as the expression of patriotism. So we need to actually not just say we're patriotic like the Tories, we need to challenge the Tories' right to call themselves patriots. We have to say that any party that can set up a system where the friends of ministers get privileged access to PPE contracts during a pandemic is not a patriotic party. Any government that sits back while millions of people can't afford their fuel bills and their shopping bills at the same time is not a party that's governing the interests of the nation. Any party that basically sits back as foreign assets, as British assets get transferred into foreign ownership to people who don't pay British taxes is not a patriotic government. So where I want to see Keir go is go beyond the patriotism of the flag to challenging the Tories' right to be a patriotic party at all. A patriotic party cares about the people of the nation. And that's where I want us to go next.
I think what's interesting there is I think a lot of Labour people would really agree with everything you just said, especially on the sort of why the Tories aren't patriotic. But what I found really interesting that you spoke about or tweeted about, I should say, recently was the fact that the majority of voters who express themselves as English first over British tend, I don't know the exact figures, but tend not to vote Labour. And those who express themselves as British first tend to vote Labour. So I tried this a bit. I went around to various CLPs and groups I'm involved with, and I asked my friends who were there and said, are you English or British first? Obviously, not like that, stuck it into conversation. And the vast majority of them said they were British. And that was really interesting, because if I repeated that at cricket club I go to, or football team I support, or literally in the shops if I wanted to, they think I'm weird. But if I did, I'd probably get the complete opposite. Do you not think then it is an issue with the party itself? And how do you think you can change that? Because right. The leader can change as much as he wants, but how do you change all the activists? Think?
Well, leadership's important. But look, the first point you've just made, it's self-awareness. We all have a tendency to assume that everybody shares our own view on identity issues, and an understanding that a Labour Party, particularly an active membership, which is younger, which is more likely to be university educated and more likely to be living in big cities, will be representative of that demographic that's around them. But the people like them are all more English than British. But the problem is, as you say, in the nation as a whole, it's not like that. Actually, a lot of people are both. That's the first thing you've got to say. But the people who are English, it's an important part of their identity. And usually surprises Labour Party members to know that there aren't more British-leaning people than there are English-leaning people. If anything, there are more people who lead to their English identity. Once you understand that, then I think the conversation becomes much easier. And once people understand that you can't win an election just on the people who are more British than English, it becomes easier. Now, the extent of this, 20 years ago, none of this really mattered, but by 2019, Boris Johnson took 80% of the votes of the part of the population that were more English than British. In 2019, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour actually won amongst the people who are more British than English. That's not where our issue is. Our issue is amongst those people who feel that we don't properly represent them, and their sense of Englishness is one of the reasons why they don't think we're speaking up for them.
Does this go further than just how do we win voters who define themselves as English? Is this now a case of, well, actually, we need an English manifesto, which is part of the manifesto just for people who say, you know, I live in England, I classify myself as English, and this is what I want. And that while that can include, you know, very nice things such as make St. George's Day a bank holiday, like they do in Ireland and several other countries around the world, but does it actually include policies directly aimed for English people living in England?
It certainly means an English manifesto, because it's part of talking about England. One of the things you'll hear if you canvassed in the sort of areas that have become quite difficult for us is people saying you're not even allowed to say you're English anymore. And if we don't recognise that people identify as English. But the second thing we need to understand, and this is probably the challenge for progressives, for party members, is that there's a reason why those English voters tracked first towards supporting Brexit and then towards Boris Johnson in the Get Brexit Done election of 2019. And that is their strong sense of democracy and sovereignty being a national level thing. Most people who are on the British end of the spectrum are much less exercised by that, much happier, for example, with the sharing of sovereignty, which is embedded in the EU. Those English voters weren't. And this is something we've got to understand. We've got to see it as a force, not to be afraid of, but as actually that vote was a democratic expression of the desire to be heard. And what Labour needs to do is have a way of saying more clearly than we do at the moment, we understand what it was you were on about. You felt in many cases your communities had been economically and politically marginalised. We do know that you felt that immigration was too much of a threat, cultural threat to your communities. But we understand that what you were saying was you wanted to be heard. A lot of people hear what I've just said and say, oh, I don't like the sound of that very much because of those immigration fears. What we've got to remember, though, is that the English, just like the British, have become far less exercised about immigration over the past 20 years, far less likely to think that Englishness is a white identity than they did 20 years ago. In other words, the sentiment has been moving in a broadly progressive direction over the last 20 years, despite Brexit, despite the election of Boris Johnson. It's why they came so badly unstuck when they started criticising England footballers for taking the knee. It turned out that English football fans were perfectly happy to see their players stand up to racism. So we've got to be a lot more confident, and we've got to take this issue of England on primarily as a democratic issue. When we talk about levelling up, we should be saying it's not just about the economy, it's about political empowerment of people in communities that feel marginalized, giving a voice to people who felt they haven't been listened to. If we can do that, we can win large numbers of people back from the Conservatives. We won't get them all. We don't need to win them all back, but we can win large numbers back.
Do you think that Englishness at the minute amongst Labour Party members has bad connotations associated with it? And that's why maybe as a party, we're a little bit scared to approach the subject. What is being English? Define being English. Are you English?
I think it does. And I think there's also been a tendency for some people to define their Britishness against an idea of a reactionary Englishness. So, you know, I can be confident in being British because I can say everything that I don't like that's reactionary is English. And that does happen quite a lot in conversation. And I do always point out to people that actually, with the sole exception of the English Defence League that only existed for about 3 years, every single far-right organisation from the 1930s onwards has been British. From the British Union of Fascists through to Britain First today, the far right organises around an idea of Britishness, not so much around an idea of Englishness. So I think that Labour Party members who define their Britishness against their Englishness need to be a lot more upfront and say Britishness is contested too. The far right are invested in Britishness. You can't just say Englishness is far right, the Britishness are all okay. It's much more complicated than that. So that's the first point. The second point, as you've heard, I push very strongly for us to understand what lies behind the motivations of English identifying voters. But I think we have to understand that none of the national identities we have in England at the moment, whether it's the British end of the spectrum or the English, give us the shared story of England that we need to take on England's political problems. So while I want Labour to reach out to today's English voters, I also want Labour to be actively involved in creating the story of 21st century England. And that's something, it's a big cultural political project, but that's something we need to belong to. I don't want in 20 years time for it still to be 80% of the English voting Conservative and Labour winning amongst the British. We have to have a story of England that everybody can take part in. And we haven't really even begun that process yet.
Do you think that might be due to maybe educationally, especially from a much younger age, an awareness of England's radical history in itself? I mean, there's a brilliant, I use this Twitter page all the time, but English Radical History, brilliant, basically collates a load of articles and dates of brilliant English radical moments throughout the entire of history. Do you think we need to be doing more to encourage that educationally, to maybe change the shift in sort of our view on England?
Yes, we do. And we need to, well, we need to do that actually about England and about Britishness, because it's where we bring things together. So if you're in an English school, you will be taught British values, you know, rule of law, democracy and all the rest of it. You won't necessarily be taught that all of these things had to be fought for. You won't necessarily be taught about anti-racist struggles, the campaign for gay liberation. Those things that we now regard as shared values are the product of struggles. And we have lost the English radical history. The history of England is not entirely radical. People who sort of say England's got a radical history as though that's it are wrong. England's got a reactionary history too, and it's got stuff in between. But there is that radical element. That's the first part of it. The second part of it, which I think is easier to do now than it was 20 years ago, is what David Olusoga calls telling everyone's story. It's the term he uses in preference to decolonization of the curriculum, which sounds sort of quite threatening. He's just saying, let's tell a history in which everybody who is here knows they have a part in that history. And what that enables us to do is bring together the history of English radicalism, the fight for justice and rights here, with the stories that other communities have brought here in the past, which also contain some of their own struggles for justice, some of which were, of course, struggles against slavery, struggles about the English Empire. I think that we're at a moment now where that conversation would have been almost impossible 20 years ago. I think because of democratic change, education, all the rest of it, it's now possible to talk about a story for England that includes all the stories of the people who are making their lives here. And that's what we need to do if we're going to have a real shared English story for the future.
I know, obviously, you're here to talk about Englishness, but we obviously have to touch on the fact that you did work in a Labour government.
Yep.
Now, I work in a Labour opposition. Ashan probably wasn't even old enough to remember the Labour government. Many of our listeners, the Labour government is something that was a great thing that happened when they were really, really young and never touched on it. But obviously, you played, you know, a leading role in that winning team. So could you tell us a little bit about what that was like to work in a Labour government for those of us who have never had the chance?
Yeah, well, the first thing I got to say is I joined the Labour Party in 1976 and we didn't win a general election until 1997. So it was good being in a Labour government. I mean, there was a Labour government when I first joined, but it was fairly relatively short-lived and it never had an overall majority and it was really quite difficult. So it took a long time before there was a Labour government. A Labour government, however bad, is much better than the alternative. That's the first point. So the single-minded focus on winning is absolutely essential. But secondly, you know, we did so much. There had never been a minimum wage. The Labour Party had first called for minimum wage 100 years previously, or the Labour Representation Committee. It took us in 1997 to introduce a minimum wage. Despite its shortcomings that we've talked about, devolution was a huge change. We embedded the European Convention of Human Rights into British law to make it more accessible. Over a period of time, we took our health spending to the level of the European average, which, because the NHS is a more efficient health system than anywhere else, gave us the highest levels of NHS satisfaction we've ever seen from patients. There was so much in the field of social reform that we did. We can be critical. We did too little to restructure the economy, to introduce a proper industrial policy until too late. We were collectively, I think, naive about the benefits of globalization and particularly didn't spot the costs of globalization. So we made errors of that sort. But you had the potential to do things which you can't do when you're in opposition. And that's why it's worth the struggle and the effort and all the things that people do to get a Labour government elected. No doubt the next Labour government won't achieve everything we want it to do. But if you compare it with what we've got at the moment, it's well worth having.
It makes me so happy to hear you say that, but then also so sad because all of the things that you were talking about have just been repealed or destroyed or, you know, in a way set back. You were talking about the NHS, for example. We have a huge backlog. You know, so many things that you were mentioning have unfortunately just peeled away. But obviously, in your brief, you worked on innovation. Could you kind of explain a little bit about what that was and how, you know, I feel like innovation is one of those terms where it's like, really, what does it mean? But for you in that role, what did that mean?
Led a department which actually then got absorbed back into the business department, was an attempt to bring together essentially research skills and applied science and innovation in a single government department. And other people can judge how effective we were, but it worked quite well for a time. The thing that interested me most about innovation essentially is not your blue skies research. Innovation is where you take your existing knowledge, but you apply it to develop a new product or new service or something of that sort. And we were looking for ways of ensuring that more of the economy was driven by innovative businesses. And the thing that I was particularly keen on, but has never really happened, was the effective use of public sector procurement to drive innovative businesses. Most of the public sector, if it buys a service, an IT system or whatever, will buy the industry standard at the lowest possible price, which means you're not creating the markets you could do for innovative companies to sell new products into the NHS or other public services. And we could have made a much bigger use of the innovation budget. And now we've lapsed back into the situation we were trying to get out of, where if you set up an innovative company in this country, your strategy is probably to sell out to a foreign buyer in about 5 years' time so the venture capitalists can get their money back. So instead of being a nation, we are a nation which has still got a lot of research excellence. We should never say that we don't, but we do turn a lot of that research into innovative business. The number of those innovative businesses that really grow and become world dominant companies is now absolutely tiny. And we need to get back to the idea of fostering an English and a British national economy by use of all the measures like procurement that we can to build those companies up.
I read your background, obviously, and I knew a bit about you before you came along to join us. And you started your career sort of as a, you're now an academic, but you started studying chemistry. How did you kind of slowly progress from that genre into this one? Because that I find quite interesting.
Okay. So I was a chemist. I played a lot of sport, particularly rugby and cricket. I was the sort of person and came from the sort of family where you tend to get involved in committees. So I got involved in running sports clubs. And then I got involved in the students' union as the athletics union secretary, which wasn't a full-time post or anything. And I was sort of vaguely on the left, but I wasn't at all an activist. And in the students' union, when I was a postgraduate, I met people who were involved in left-wing politics and realised there were bigger issues than whether you could get the rugby club to pay up for smashing up the Bath University bar last Saturday and the things I was dealing with as athletic union secretary. So ultimately, having done a year as union president, I never went back to my PhD and I went off to a career in the voluntary sector and I was engaged as a Labour Party activist. The good news from my point of view is that 40 years later, the university gave me an honorary doctorate in chemistry. So I got the PhD in the end, but that's how it happened. So it was by chance. And I got selected as a parliamentary candidate by chance, by one vote, when everybody, including me, thought somebody else was going to win. So unlike some people who have a carefully plotted political career, I have been extraordinarily lucky. Opportunities have opened up at the right times, given me the chance to do things, and I, you know, for which I'm eternally grateful.
And what's it like to be asked to serve in a Labour government?
I mean, it's fantastic. What happened in 19... I mean, I only talk about my own experience. In 1997, the Social Security team had largely been put in place ahead of the election, and I was the shadow pensions minister. And we were given the heads up several weeks before the general election that if we won, we would go into the jobs that we had. So it was quite nice. And I was lucky in a way because I had, in opposition, I had concentrated on pensions policy, and particularly a probably now long forgotten scandal, but about the mis-selling of personal pensions, where I'd done a lot of campaigning, was one of the first MPs to raise it consistently in Parliament. So I, for me, it was great because I didn't go into a department about which I knew nothing. I went into a department where I knew some of the things I wanted to achieve. We could start them straight away. And within a year or so, we had very dramatically reduced the cost that people were paying if they took out a personal pension, which, you know, I'm pleased to say there will be people out there today with a much bigger pension income than they would have had if Labour hadn't come in and cut the cost of their pension savings. So I was lucky because I was able to come in with a fair idea of what I wanted to achieve. And I was given the authority and the backing to do it, even though I was quite a junior minister.
So if you can go back to having any brief in a Labour government, what would be the one, maybe two policies you'd implement? Maybe aside from the English stuff that we know you're interested in, what would be the two that maybe when you were back there that you couldn't do or you really wanted to do that you would do now?
I would have loved to have been communities and local government secretary 10 years earlier, because that was the last job I had in government where we were really in the run-up to what many of us feared would be the election defeat of 2010. If I'd been there 10 years earlier, I could have pushed through perhaps the radical devolution of powers to cities, counties and communities that I now think are necessary. I could have got us away from the obsession with really remote and unaccountable regional structures, which in the end the Tories were able to strip away and the Lib Dems were able to throw away within, you know, 3 months of us being in power. So I think I'd like that job, but I wish I'd had it earlier and with long enough to push through radical changes.
Just to end on that, a lot of people who are listening to the podcast go out campaigning when election cycles come, but don't fully understand the power of local government. But you seem like somebody who's completely pro local government and is a huge supporter. Could you try and quickly explain why you're such a fan?
Because decisions taken closer to local people will be better decisions than decisions taken in Whitehall. The prevailing culture in Whitehall is always that we know better. We know better how to do things. It's just not true. And every community is different. You know, if you're trying to help people who are living in poverty with bad health problems in Cornwall, the issues won't be the same as they are in Manchester. And you have to serve services tailored by local people for local people. And, you know, one issue there is at the moment, I know that some people, and particularly younger people, will look at local authorities and say, well, my local authority seems to lack expertise, it lacks skills, it lacks capacity. That is a consequence of 10 years of austerity under the current government, in which lots of local authorities have lost their best officers, their most capable people. The answer for Labour coming into power is not to rebuild Whitehall. It's to rebuild the power of local government and power of local administration and trust local people. If you do that, then the activists you're talking about, the activists who might listen to this programme, who are out on the doorstep for the local elections in May, will know that most of the time it was an argument about voting for Keir Starmer's Labour Party or Boris Johnson's Partygate. I would like to have a situation where those elections were actually about what was happening in those communities and discussions with voters who knew that their local council had the power to do something about it. There is no nation in Europe that controls so much spending and so much revenue raising from the centre and allows local areas so little scope to raise money and so little discretion in how it spends money. And that's why it sometimes seems so very difficult for local government to make a difference. But we ought to be the party that really believes that local government can.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for. A big thank you to John for joining us today. It was great to hear what he had to say. If you want to read a bit more about what John gets up to and his other work, you can look at his blog at theoptimisticpatriot.co.uk. You can look at his Twitter at jydenham, or you can look at his website, theenglishlabournetwork.org.uk. All of these links we've put in the episode's description. If you enjoy listening to us, please subscribe to this episode to be notified when our new episodes come out. We also have a mailing list called the Left Wingers Community, which you can join using the link in the episode's description. You can also keep in touch with us using our social media. We love to hear what you have to say, so please get in touch. Keep whinging, let us know if you are English, and we'll see you next week.